Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Welcome back to the Drive On podcast. Today, my guest is Martha LaGuardia Cotite. Martha was introduced to me by a mutual friend, Ashley Leppert, who has been a guest on this podcast a couple of times now. And Martha served as one of the first female officers to serve aboard two Coast Guard cutters with all male crews. And she led teams during numerous disasters for 29 years at sea and ashore. Martha is also the award-winning author of several books, which we'll talk about a little bit later. And she's here today to discuss her career and how she was able to overcome various obstacles in her path throughout her career. So welcome to the show, Martha. I'm really excited to have you here.
Thank you so much, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with you and your story and your background, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks. I grew up in a fishing village called Destin, Florida, and it's actually the same place where I received my appointment to go to the Coast Guard Academy. And so from there, I did go to the Coast Guard Academy and served over 29 years in the Coast Guard. And then I ended up subsequently retiring there, which was so cool. The Master Chief and his crew did a phenomenal job sending me off on my way. And during those 29 years, I was blessed and honored to have served in such a great service, the United States Coast Guard, and paved the way in some new areas, for not only for myself, but for the Coast Guard, and like to think that I made a difference.
Well, absolutely. And I've had several Coast Guard veterans on the podcast before, Ashley included, and a couple others. But one of the things that sort of surprises me is when I start talking to these people who were in the Coast Guard and hearing about all these things that you guys have done around the country. And a lot of times it goes without a lot of fanfare. When there's troops getting deployed to Afghanistan or Iraq, it's headline news. That's what everyone's talking about for weeks and weeks or months and years on end. It's talking about the war. It's talking about all the combat troops and all this stuff. But when you have people in the Coast Guard who are rescuing boaters who are stranded out at sea or in a lake or wherever it may be, or rescuing during a natural disaster, hurricanes and floods and all that kind of stuff. Those people are out there, yourself included, Ashley, other people I've talked to, you're out there and you're making a difference in these people's lives, literally life and death decisions. If you guys weren't there, if you weren't doing the things that you're doing, you literally, these people wouldn't make it through the disasters that they're living through. You're living through some of their worst times. And so I wanted to say that just in an acknowledgement. I know a lot of times amongst the various branches of the military, we kind of rag on each other and things like that. Coast Guard, I think, kind of gets the worst of it sometimes. But I do want to say how much I appreciate everything that the Coast Guard does. And so I'm excited to have you here to talk about your career and everything that you've done.
Well, thanks. And to your point, that's exactly what happened when I came to realize I wanted to write my first book, which was a book that started out to show two sides of the Coast Guard, our small boat missions, what we do at sea and close to shore, and also in the aviation community. And then as publishers would have it, they wanted more of a certain storyline. And so that's when I had to focus strictly on aviation and the Coast Guard Rescue Squad program. And that team of people that are flying in the helicopter, descending down at the moment when someone can nearly die and putting themselves on the line and then off the hoist, as you know, to risk their lives to save strangers, and many times without so much as a thank you. So the recognition was not there at the time that I was writing this book. And also the acknowledgement of this amazing community of people was not necessarily known by many of us in the Coast Guard, because I had served on two ships by that time, and then ended up in what I call my passion, was to tell the Coast Guard story as a public affairs officer for the Pacific Northwest. And I walked into the office one day and heard of them retelling this story about a cave rescue where a helicopter flew into the cave. The rescue swimmer newly lost his life. One of the two brothers was recovered. The other had not made it by the time the rescue swimmer got back into the cave to see what was going on. And then how he got himself out of there with the survivor was a near-death experience and just incredible. And I thought, how come I didn't hear about this? I served in the United States Coast Guard. I was a lieutenant at the time. And I thought, gosh, I would have known that this had happened, but I didn't. And so this was at a time when I felt that we needed to recognize what these unsung heroes in our service are doing. And so that's when I set out to write this collection of amazing stories that are really legendary. And the aviation community for the Coast Guard basically put their stamp of approval on it too, because nothing in there isn't what they are proud of. They are so proud of this book, and they're so proud to have this history preserved. And that was my mission, was to preserve their history, acknowledge their heroism, and help more people around the earth understand how phenomenal they are. And I am not a rescue swimmer. I've got to say that. Everybody thinks because I wrote the book, I can swim like one, and I certainly cannot.
Right. But you're absolutely right with that. The level of dedication to the job, to, like you said, flying a helicopter into a cave is like, that's something I would never even think of doing. If I was the person in charge to say, okay, there's someone who needs to get rescued, it's okay. Oh, well, we're not sending a helicopter in, because that just would not be right on top of my mind. But here they are figuring things out and getting the job done, even with potentially risking their own lives to make sure that this mission got accomplished. So again, Coast Guard, I feel like, gets a bad rap sometimes with the military community, but what the work that the entire service does is truly incredible. And hearing some of the stories, like the one that you just mentioned, and other people that I've talked to, is just really inspiring and really incredible. So I'd love to get into your story a little bit here. And in the intro, I mentioned that you were one of the first female officers to serve on a couple different cutters with all male crews. And when I served in the Army, I was an infantryman, and that was before women were able to serve in combat arms roles. And when that transition took place, there was some grumbling going on about having women in a traditionally all-male role. And that was in the news. That was not anything covered up or anything like that, right? But was there any sort of resistance to you being one of the first women to step into that role on the cutters that you were on?
There certainly was, and I think it's not unusual back then at that time to face this resistance, especially when you were the first women to come on board a ship. They've not served with women before. It was a crew of 65 men, dozen officers, and I think they just didn't understand, you know, who we were as people, and that we were there to be professionals and get a job done, because we had earned our right to be there, and we had gone through the training and all the trials to get our commission. And so we had earned our place. We just needed to prove ourselves that we were capable. And so that took some time, and that took some tugging back and forth, if you will, to show that, yes, I can get my qualifications as a deck watch officer. Yes, I can do the boardings, and I can learn and complete the requirements. And yes, I can help you with this and that. And I think it goes back to me when it's wonderful that we can go back and reflect on those times of challenge. And one of the things I've learned, I've turned it into what I call my rules of engagement. And so my rules of engagement, which I love to speak about as a keynote speaker, are be bold, be first, and be you. So these three rules apply to everyone, no matter what your circumstance, and helps you achieve your bigger dream or accomplish that goal that you have in front of you. And so my first two assignments, being the only woman on board a ship, actually my first ship was with my roommate, the second ship I was the only one, where in both cases there was resistance, mostly because people just didn't understand who we are. And I got to give a lot of credit to some enlightened individuals like my first chief, Quartermaster Chief Stephen Mackey on my first ship, who was bold. Just like we were bold coming on board and accepting this assignment, he was bold to reciprocate and say, I believe in you. I see that you can do this. You can perform what you need to do on your watch, just like anyone else, and that your gender doesn't matter. And I believe in you. So he was an influential person to help show that you can have mentor people that don't look, think, or act like them, and you can create this cohesive team and help change the culture by being bold. So I think it was a two-way street, not only myself being bold and taking a step into an unknown, but also my chief being bold and saying, I believe in you, I'm going to give you a chance, and then others followed. So in the end, it was very successful, and obviously I got a second tour afloat as executive officer on a 110-foot patrol boat, which was pretty much an amazing opportunity. And I love that assignment as well.
Yeah. And so it seems like, you know, it's really just getting out there, doing the job and showing to the people who were maybe doubting you, doubting your abilities, whatever, just because of who you are as a woman, right? And just getting out there and doing the job and showing, hey, look, I can do this. There's nothing really standing in my way other than maybe you and your own preconceived notions of what you're able to do, right? It's like, but get out of my way so I can go and do the job that I'm here to do. And it seems like obviously having the support from the leadership on that ship was also beneficial to you as well. But by having that attitude of, like, I'm here to get this job done and I'm going to be bold. I'm going to be myself. I'm just going to go out and do this stuff. It allowed you to prove yourself and move on to another position, again, as one of the only female on the ship, right? And it allowed you to prove yourself in bigger and better ways. And it seems like you've built on that throughout your career as you've stepped up into increasingly more responsibilities and in higher level positions. You were able to build on that, right? So, you know, how were you able to, I don't know if you want to start as far back as when you joined the Coast Guard, but were you able to see your path when you first started? And were you able to kind of pave your own path and work your way to get to a certain destination in your career? How did that work for you?
Yeah, I think it's always easier to look back, right? And say, oh, this is why that made sense or why that didn't work quite right. But you know, jumping into this, it was literally jumping in, being totally blind and not really understanding that even today, women or officers especially are such a small percentage of all the services. What is it? Maybe 12%, if that, across officers and enlisted, and maybe 6 or 7% for officers. Don't quote me on those numbers because I didn't look them up recently, but so yeah, I think I was pretty unaware of what I was getting involved with. And my goal was to get a great college education and also to make a difference. And the missions of the Coast Guard met that make a difference desire and save lives and the environment, as well as getting the great education and travel that I sought personally. So as far as paving my path and finding my way, it was a matter of, okay, the Coast Guard is going to require me after the Coast Guard Academy and my commission to go to sea. Okay, I'll go to sea. And as much as all of us complain, and the majority of us were like, oh, I don't think we want to do this, it was some of the most phenomenal, most wonderful and adventurous experiences of my life. And yeah, sure, there were those challenges along the way, those moments that I wish that, you know, I didn't have to experience certain difficulties like everyone does in life, because it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. Your gender doesn't matter as we go through life. But I was able to pick out the things that I really enjoy doing and sort of drive towards that, starting to understand myself, which was the third part of my rules of engagement: be bold, be first, and be you. So when you're yourself, your authentic self, you start to recognize what you're passionate about. And then you can say, okay, in my case, for my first assignment, one of the first patrols was to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. So here, this huge oil spill was happening in this pristine area called Prince William Sound, Alaska. And of course, the public, the people that live and work there are all upset. and the news media wants interviews. Well, this was at a time when the military was so not into giving interviews and they couldn't find people to do interviews. So I was like, well, I'll talk to the people of Whittier, Alaska. I'll talk to the press. I'll help write the press release because I knew I liked writing. I knew I liked telling stories. And this was being a young kid. I enjoyed writing and telling stories. So I thought, well, let's try it. So I learned on my feet how to do these public relations things and found I really enjoyed it. Meanwhile, no one else was raising their hand because they didn't want to be in front of a camera or go out and talk to people outside the safety, if you will, of being in the military and on our ship. So once I discovered part of myself, part of being me, was to tell stories in the very fundamental way and to meet people and to tell what we're doing to make a difference, how we're helping save your environment or help save lives or that rescue we did. I thought, gosh, I really like this. And how do I get more of that? So while I had to listen to what the Coast Guard wanted, sometimes I refused to get the master's, so to speak. I was asked, why don't you get a master's in public administration? You're on the fast track for going back to sea again. We want to see you commanding a ship. And I'm like, public administration? I just couldn't get it. And it wasn't something I had a passion for. Now, if they said journalism or media relations, and I did apply for those opportunities, but was always a second alternate because my male colleagues got it, and good for them. But ultimately, I did become a spokesperson for the Coast Guard. Ultimately, I did fulfill my dream of getting a master's in journalism, and I got it from Harvard of all places, all because I wanted to be me. And so I carved that niche that didn't exist in all the services at that time in a field that was thought to be for those who are on their way out. They couldn't possibly succeed as commanding officers, given the PR, the spokesperson job, ironically. And I took it on as, this is something I can be good at and I can do a good job for you, United States Coast Guard. And there was a core cadre of us that formed a team that believed that we could do a great job and get our service out there in the best light and in the honest light and tell the truth, even if it went bad sometimes in terms of a story or a rescue. And we helped promote our service and helped promote the people that so deserve the recognition.
Yeah, and getting a master's from, well, anywhere, but Harvard especially, is not the easiest cakewalk type of thing to do, right? And I could only imagine if you just followed what other people were telling you to do, different career paths it could have taken that could have fast-tracked you to a different command position or whatever it was that you might have gotten yourself into, but it wasn't really where your passion lied. I would imagine that it would probably make it that much harder for you to complete that degree or the training or whatever it is that you needed to do because your heart wasn't there. Your heart wasn't in it. And when you decided to follow your passion, follow the stuff that you're interested in, then I'm not saying it's easy for you to do any of the stuff that you did, but when there's passion behind it, it does make it a little bit easier. You have that goal in front of you. It's like, I want to be this. I want to do this. I want to get there. And you can see that clearly. And it helps you to bring that best effort forward. Whereas if it's something that you're just sort of doing because someone else is telling you that you should be doing it or whatever, I can't really see the passion being there as much as something that you really are interested in, right?
Right. And I'll admit there were some jobs that I didn't want to take, but the assignment officer said, this is where we need you. This is where you're going. Sure. And because of my lack of knowledge or lack of experience, I didn't necessarily agree, but I had to go along with it. So every now and then you have to say yes to orders and take those orders. But at the same time, you can still keep listening to yourself, your authentic self, and what is it that you're excited about? What is it that you always wanted to do that you haven't had a chance to do yet, whether it's within your job, the community, or on the outside, maybe athletically or adventure, whatever it is, always listen to that voice that is your authentic self, it is you. And I guarantee you, you will be able to make a huge impact, make a difference, whatever your goal is. And it brings great reward to not only the people that are around you because you're authentic, they can trust you, they know you're real, but also to yourself, it brings fulfillment. And fulfillment isn't necessarily money. Fulfillment is the satisfaction that you've made a difference, you've made an impact in a positive way. And we have so much power as individuals to be able to do that.
Yeah, and it feels good too when you accomplish something that you're passionate about, that you set out, you know it's not going to be the easiest thing, but it's something that you want to do and you work hard at it and you accomplish whatever this is, whether it's a certain degree or a project or whatever it is that you're doing in your life, and you apply yourself, you work hard, you get it done. At the end of the day, you can look back at it and say, holy crap, I did this. But, you know, and maybe a few months or a couple of years earlier, it may not have seemed possible, but then you look back and it's like, I did this. This is something to be proud of. And it, you know, that just makes you, overall, it makes you feel good about yourself and your abilities and everything like that. And I think that's pretty incredible. I mean, I know to your point about having to do certain jobs that maybe you weren't totally passionate about. I know when I first graduated college, I worked a few jobs that I did them. They weren't totally my passion, but I worked on my passion in my own time and stuff that I was interested in. And now I have a business that is doing the stuff that I'm passionate about. And so I was able to work my way to get to that point. And for me, it's just fulfilling knowing that I was able to put in the time and the effort to get there. So I know exactly where you're coming from. And I encourage people to follow your advice and follow in your footsteps as far as following that passion and doing those things that that really light that fire inside of you and make you feel good about what it is that you're doing, right?
Yes. And one other thing I'd like to add is, so in my rules of engagement that applies to anyone's life, and whether you're in business, military, what have you, just starting out or in a place where you're looking to transition, whatever that is, the rules are be bold, be first, and be you. So part of being first is not necessarily the kind of career path that I've had where you say, oh, Martha, you were first here and first there and first to do that. There are plenty of opportunities to be first, and you don't have to be a four-star admiral. You don't have to be the first to do whatever assignment where you get all the recognition. Being first can be as simple as recognizing that something needs to be done and raising your hand and or volunteering to do it. That's being first. You're helping become a catalyst for change. And it doesn't have to have all sorts of other accolades to go with it, but you can drive change by being first and being mindful and thoughtful of what things should be changed or should be different and help others come together to see that. So I think that's important too, is that there are plenty of firsts left to be conquered and to be done so that we all have better lives.
Yeah. And there's tons of examples of that where you're in the military and the first sergeant's coming around looking for someone to help out with a certain thing. And you see a room full of people just sitting around like, no, I'm not volunteering for that. But it's like, you know what? Volunteer and help out, do the thing the right way, your way, and be able to feel good that you're able to make a change, make a difference in, you know, whatever it is that you're doing. Being first, being that person who steps up and volunteers for those types of things. Yes, it would be great to be the first person to walk on the moon or whatever. Obviously, those things have been done before, but the first person to walk on Mars, all those things would be great to do. There's only going to be one person to be the first to do that type of thing. But if you can find that thing for you that makes you the first on top of the game, that's going to set you up pretty well, I think, too. So you're right. There's a lot of firsts out there. It's just being open to figuring out what those firsts are for each individual.
Right. And it may be a new technique. Like one of the rescue swimmers I write about in my first book called So Others May Live, Coast Guard Rescue Swimmer, Saving Lives, Defying Death. I don't know if you have video when you post, but here's the cover of it. So chapter three is the story of Senior Chief Jack Tunks. And not only was he the first to have a rescue outside the training scenario, because when this program started, we were still wrapping our sweaters in blankets, so to speak, and saying, no, you're not leaving the safety of this cabin or going outside of a training scenario because it's too high risk and we don't want that risk. So the pilots would say, sit in the back of the aircraft, and we're up in Alaska in Jeff's case. We don't get many fires up here, but if we get a fire, we'll let you know. But until then, just hang out. So the rescue that forever changed the half of the program took place in Alaska, which is chapter three in my book. And it was just phenomenal. And he had to face his fears. And it came down to, we're not able to save this father and son from the sinking fishing vessel. Would you like to try and descend into chaos and this incredible storm that we are now in, trying to save them with heavy seas in the darkness of night in Alaska? And he says, I'll go in. And he was the first rescue swimmer to leave the safety of the cabin and effect a rescue and come back alive. And the crew almost lost the aircraft that night. They almost didn't get Jeff Tunks back into the aircraft, but they did save the father and son. And it was really kind of a miracle rescue. Like, the worst that could happen happened. They were able to recover everyone, and the helicopter was grounded from the stresses that it had to bear just to fly back home. And so non-believers became believers because he was the first. And then fast forward decades to Hurricane Katrina. And who's in Mobile, Alabama, at the training center when Katrina hits in New Orleans? And we're finding for the first time that we now have people stuck inside homes on the second and third floor. And when the only way to get them is through the roof. Whoever trained for that? No one.
No.
And the axe that exists in the helicopter is a small axe for getting them out of the aircraft should it ditch in water or in a situation where they need to, you know, crack the door to get out the window. And so Jeff was innovative from his assignment at Mobile in helping devise new techniques to help rescue people during Katrina. And of course, I had to run to Home Depot and get a bigger axe. But that innovation hasn't stopped for the rescue swimmer program, for people like Jeff Tunks. And I think once you get into that mode of being courageous, facing your fear, going out to where no one has gone before, and of course you're trained and you're the best you can be at that moment, but you use everything that you have gained in your training and your wisdom and your experience or lack of experience, and you take that step. And you go out, and man, you could save lives in the case of these rescue swimmers and aviation, the crew members and pilots. It's just phenomenal.
It is, absolutely. And the amount of innovation that comes out of the military, all branches, that you hear stories of things like this all the time. That's a perfect example of how that outside the box thinking, not just using the equipment that's issued to you, but running out to Home Depot and getting a giant axe to be able to chop through a roof, right? That's outside the box. That's not just sitting back and saying, oh, well, I don't have the equipment for it, I can't do it kind of thing. That's someone who, again, was the first to say, hey, we don't have this equipment, let's go get it and let's get the job done.
Yeah.
No matter what it takes, we're going to get it done. There's people out there who need to be rescued. They need to be saved. And we're going to figure this out. Even if it means chopping up the roof with a giant axe, we'll figure it out and we'll get it done. And I know when I was training to go to Afghanistan, we had a situation where we got a lot of our Humvees stuck in the mud. On it was the dirt road that we were driving on. It gotten washed out, and we thought we could make it through. We ended up not being able to make it through. And we were in the woods, and so we fortunately had some axes with us. We chopped up a whole bunch of trees. We used those to get traction out from underneath, but we could have just sat there and said, well, send us a wrecker to come pull us out, but we figured it out. It was hard. It was frustrating. It was potentially dangerous because none of us were, you know, professionals at chopping down trees or anything like that, but we did it anyways, and we figured it out. And we got the job done. And it's just innovation, like the stuff that you're talking about, outside the box thinking, just really helps to just show how far people are willing to go, especially in cases like this where it's literal life and death situations for some of these people on the ground with their houses being flooded and everything like that. It's like, no, we're not going to just be okay with saying, oh, well, it's too bad we don't have the equipment. We're going to get this job done. And that to me is very motivating, and knowing that there's people out there that are willing to push the envelope and think outside the box like that, right?
Can I share with you my other book?
Sure, absolutely.
So it's called, it's having a hard time seeing it, Changing the Rules of Engagement.
Yes.
Inspiring Stories of Courage and Leadership from Women in the Military. And so while it's profiling 17 amazing, fearless women who were trailblazers and helped change the culture of the military. I mean, that's a huge statement right there. But they were bold, they were first, and they were themselves. They wouldn't have been able to accomplish becoming the first female to command one of the space shuttles, right? Command a space shuttle, or the first female Thunderbird pilot, or the Marine drill instructors, changing lives, helping people come from society where they didn't believe in themselves and their shoulders are slouched to becoming these graduates that now serve in the United States Marine Corps. And they're proud of who they are, and they're proud of their country, and they're proud of their service. So the reason I bring this up is because this book changed my life. I was so influenced by these women, and I felt like I hadn't done nothing, and here they have done all these amazing things. What on earth am I going to accomplish now? And it came down to being in a group one day, and we asked each other, and we each had to answer. And I never anticipated asking the question. I was like leading the group. Okay, now you all go up to someone you haven't met before and ask them, what is the one thing that you always wanted to do that you haven't done yet? So they would answer the question. And then the girl that I had asked turned around and asked me. And I'm like, wow, I have to answer this question too. And what occurred to me, and if you do this exercise, it might be quite interesting and eye-opening, is the one thing that I hadn't done up to that point, I was mid-career, was gotten my degree in journalism, because I had become this pro media relations spokesperson woman for the United States Coast Guard, but I had 5 days of training. I didn't have the schooling, everything was grassroots, and I did a really good job, but I felt like I hadn't validated myself. And if you compare me to the next person who got the degree plus this and that, I felt like, gosh, I really want to get that degree. And then plus it helped for promotion. I found out later that I had to have it anyway. But I got it in journalism, and I discovered I could get it at Harvard. And I thought, oh, my God, well, can I do this? And, you know, it was nerve-wracking. I didn't know if I could do it. And I just took that step by being bold, being first myself, and being myself. And I fulfilled it. And I give credit to all the ladies that I interviewed in this book for influencing me, because they're so relatable to each of us, men, women, no matter how old we are, how young we are. But if you want to achieve your bigger dream, it's about surrounding yourself with a team of supporters who believe in you. It's about being bold. It's about being first. And it's about being yourself. And just figure out where you want to go. Maybe ask yourself that question. What is the one thing you've always wanted to do that you haven't done yet? And carve out the steps. And talk to people who know, who can help guide you and believe in you. And you'll get there. Guarantee it. You will get there.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point that you just made, is talk to the people who have been there already, who have maybe struggled through the process to get to where you want to be. And they can maybe help you get to that point. I don't want to say easier, because sometimes struggle is a good thing to help you learn the process and everything, but they can show you the path. And so that way it's a lot easier to get to your destination if you have the roadmap in front of you, right? As opposed to just stumbling your way across and, mm-hmm. and managing to make it to that destination somehow by some mm-hmm. grace of God or something. If you have that roadmap laid out in front of you, it just makes that whole process that much easier. And I think it's necessary to have some sort of mentor to help guide you along that path, right?
And it's a guide. And life is, you might agree with this, Scott. Tell me what you think. Life is a zig and a zag. It's not a boom, day one of 29 years in my career. I know exactly where I'm going to end up. Not at all. Not even close. I zigged, I zagged. I did this, did that. I failed at that, but did well at that. And it's not easy.
No, it's not. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of zigging and zagging that goes on in life in general. You might start a career that you're like, I'm all in, I'm passionate about this. And you find out it sucks and you hate it. And after a few years, it's like, I don't want to do this anymore. So you figure out what else you can do, maybe with your skill set, and you move on and you pivot into something else and you grow. It's not failure that you tried something and it didn't work out. It's a learning opportunity. You now know that, okay, that thing that you did before is not the thing that you wanted to do. And now you move on. Cool. You can check that box. You've done it. And now you can move on and try something else. But it's all about learning from the past. You said a couple times already, you can look back in hindsight and see all of the steps that you took to get to a certain place, right? And that place may be good or bad, but you'll be able to see what took place over that time period. And the best thing I think is that you learn a lesson from all of it. Just mm-hmm. take the time to learn, right?
And then one thing I would like to share too, I think I read where June is PTSD Awareness Month. And I know we also have a month where it's suicide awareness. And there's a connection, I believe, between PTSD and suicide prevention. And I'm a huge advocate for helping those who need help to prevent suicides. And I believe, having witnessed losing my own brother, my older brother, to suicide when I was a young person, a teenager in high school, I've made it part of my life to make a difference and save lives. And I never thought I would end up in the Coast Guard, but that met all those mission needs for me personally. And what I want to say in the gist of what I've learned a lot from that experience, but I've also learned from others. And I was blessed with the opportunity when I was a lieutenant in that Pacific Northwest office, telling the Coast Guard story as a public affairs officer. One day a chaplain walked in, didn't know me, didn't know anything about my background. And he said, Martha, I need help telling this story. It's a suicide prevention story. We have a young man who's accomplished, you know, very successful. He's attempted suicide and shot the side of his face off with a shotgun. He has lived and he's willing to tell this story about why that was not a good idea. So I was instrumental in working with the Chaplain Corps, which is also part of the Navy, as you know, in developing a suicide prevention video and training where I interviewed people who had lost someone to suicide. And I interviewed this survivor of his own attempt on his life. And all the while this was happening, I had not healed, unknowingly had not healed from the loss of my own brother. So while I was going through this process of interviewing, asking questions, learning, documenting, filming these people who had lost someone that they lost, I was healing in my own way too. And of course, I had like nightmares at night and was going through my own PTSD, which of course, early on and years ago, we never knew it was called PTSD. And I'm sure mine is a mild version. I'm not saying I'm anything close to what I know people who have severe PTSD have. I'm not comparing myself to that, but I'm saying I had my own struggle mentally too with regard to healing from the loss of someone. And I got help by going through this process and learning and meeting others who had lost someone. And I think some of the greatest gifts that came from this that we were able to share through this video and this training was a doctor at Madigan Army Hospital in Washington State had shared that people are walking around feeling suicidal every day. You don't know who they are. There could be 20, 50 people on the sidewalk in front of you. And some of those people are feeling suicidal. For those of you who are feeling suicidal, recognize that it is a temporary situation. It is temporary. And suicide is a permanent choice. And when someone elects to take their own life, you leave behind a disaster of pain, of trauma, of loss, of all these people that you might not know love you. They love you. And you leave a hole in that space where you belong. And we each have a place and a purpose for being here in this life. And you have a role to play. And if you need help or are feeling suicidal, it's time to ask for help. And it's okay, because there are 50 other people within your realm that are probably feeling suicidal too. And it's time to ask for help and feel good about it and recognize that you can get help. You can see the light again, and you can live that life and fulfill your purpose and your passion, because you have a place here. And life is precious, and you are precious. And I can only tell you from the loss of my brother that I still think about him most days. It took decades for me to not think about him every day and feel so filled with loss, because he was my role model, my leader, my path into life. And it was crushing. And we had no idea what he would do. And all I can say is, it's a selfish decision, and you can't see the light. And I hope that helps.
I think it does. You're right. There are people out there, and you don't necessarily know who they are, who are walking around struggling. Could just be a person you bump into at the coffee shop or walking down the sidewalk or whatever. And we don't know everybody's story. We don't know the struggles that they're going through in their life. And in addition to everything that you just said, which I totally agree with the sentiments that you had to offer there, I think it goes a long way just to be a nice person to people. Hold the door for someone when it looks like they're, you know, carrying something heavy, that or a mother with a newborn in the car seat or whatever, as they're walking in, like, hold the door. Like, she doesn't need to fumble her way through getting into the whatever the store, whatever that you might be going into. Just be nice. And it takes 2 seconds to do something nice like that. And it could just help out that person's day, right?
Exactly. And I love the symbolism of what you said by opening the door for someone that's carrying something heavy. Well, you might not see that heaviness that they're carrying. It could be invisible. It could be internal. Mm-hmm. And we never know what a smile or a kind word or a hug or just a moment of eye contact as human beings, right, and telling someone that they're important and that you're glad that they're there. It can be all the help that they need just to feel like that someone cared about them.
Right.
And I think as human beings, we owe that to each other.
I think you gave me a lot more credit than I deserved there. I was not trying to be symbolic or anything with the heaviness.
That was really good.
but I'll take it. That's a win for me. I'll take that. So in addition to everything else that we discussed today, you're a keynote speaker. I think we briefly mentioned that. And you're author of several books. Where can people go to get more information about getting to book you to speak? And where can they find your books?
Well, thank you. My website is marthakotite.com. So it's Martha, MARTHA, Kotite, KOTITE.com. I have my books listed there. There's 5. And my books are available wherever books are sold, and you can get them online or in your local bookstore. And I highly encourage you to support the independent bookstores. They are struggling, and they do support authors like me. And I'd love to speak for you, for your organization, your college, your group, your business, whatever it is. And I do, you know, customize my presentations to fit the needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I will have links to all of that in the show notes, to your website and to where they can find the books on your site and everything. And that way everyone can reach out, get in touch, hopefully book you for some speaking engagements and getting some copies of your book as well. Yeah, absolutely. So it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. I really do appreciate you taking the time to come on, and I want to thank you again for joining us and sharing your story and the words of inspiration that you had to offer. So thank you.
Well, thank you to you. I appreciate your time and thanks for what you're doing.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.